Hey, welcome to the seventh installment of Technician Talk. Carm Capriato here with episode 444, where we're getting a perspective from the universe of these three aftermarket technicians. We're here with Bob Hype, Peter Landry, and Matt Fonslow to discuss what it takes to be a professional in our industry.
Being in this trade, we have a lot of accumulated knowledge that interacts and intertwines. And yet when we're behind the counter talking to somebody about their vehicle, they don't have anywhere near that base knowledge. And we're talking about some fairly complex things. And, you know, we can make things as complex as we want, honestly. But sometimes we oversimplify so much to the point that we devalue what we're actually doing.
Welcome, aftermarketers, to Remarkable Results Radio. Listen to learn just one thing from today's episode on your journey to remarkable results. Hey, Carm Capriato here, the Aftermarkets Podcast guy, and in a minute, another wide open discussion with Bob, Pete, and Matt. But first, I'm so proud to partner with Apex. You know, even in this technology-driven world, nothing beats the face-to-face meetings that I've had at Apex. Now, I know that you'll value what you learn and take away at Apex, so plan now to attend. It's the perfect time to commit to go to Apex, November 5th through the 7th, 2019. It's at the Sands Expo in Las Vegas, and if you earn your living in the aftermarket, Apex is for you. Biggest of its kind. And if you're a technician, you'll need to check out Mobility Garage. For information, visit aapexshow.com. Registration is open right now, and I hope to see you there. You know, I think a lot about getting our message to our aftermarket community. It matters to me to get these stories, ideas, insights out to every corner of the aftermarket. And you can help so we rise to new levels of success. Share this with a friend. Now, Tech Talk 7 with Bob Hype, Peter Landry, and Matt Fonslow. We talk professionalism in the aftermarket, or the lack thereof. Find the talking points at remarkableresults.biz/E444. This outspoken trio wonders how professionalism is bred, how it starts, and how it can be compartmentalized. They say that everyone must step up and set the bar high for others to emulate and follow. They say that shops need to get OE-level service information to best understand how to repair the most common brands that they see in their bays. And these guys also wonder why shops that are not equipped to service certain vehicles advertise that they can. As you've come to appreciate, a wide-open discussion. Prepare yourself. Hey, a warm welcome to Bob Hype, Peter Landry, Matt Fonslow. Hey, I said that right, Pete. I've always been beat there. I know.
It's the seventh time we've done it, so you got it right.
Yeah, Technician Roundtable Part 7. Good to have you guys back. I have no clue what we're going to talk about because we've talked about everything, right?
Never.
We're going to keep it simple, just the meaning of life.
Okay, perfect. Well, then it won't be painful to listen to this. It'll be great. Good to have you guys back. Great scheduling thing, Bob. We had to work around your new vinyl planking.
Well, it wasn't so much the vinyl planking. It was the fact that because of the vinyl planking, I couldn't find my headset and microphone.
Now we hear the truth. Good. Thanks for saying confession. So, hey, let's talk professionalism in the industry, Matt.
Well, I think it's kind of lacking on many levels, or for sure two levels, at the technician level and then also the ownership management level. And there's probably a lot of different ways to define it, but the one that kind of gets me is the shops seem wildly ill-equipped to be servicing the vehicles they say they can service or are marketing that they can service.
Hey, they're the dealer alternative.
That happens, or state of the art. You see that a lot in ads, you know, state of the art facility, state of the art equipment. You know, you go to their websites, they advertise they do computer diagnostics, which that I'm not going to pick on. I don't know.
I learned everything on YouTube.
Right. And they have a scan tool in the shop, and it's aftermarket. And depending on who bought it, it might be fairly weak anyways, even if it's a high quality aftermarket scan tool. It has a lot of holes. And a lot of these shops, it's beyond my ability to sympathize or comprehend that if they were to look in their service information systems, they would see that the car lines that dominate the bays are usually one or two car lines at least, right? And why aren't they stepping up to the plate and getting OE level on those one, two, three car lines, getting OE service information to fully service these vehicles? I don't understand it.
The most valuable thing we have, it's the time and effort to find out what they are, right?
And there's resources to do that. You know, NASDAQ isn't too bad. And now with all the social media, Facebook pages and groups, diag.net, IATN, there is a lot of resources out there for low cost to figure out what you need to properly service a vehicle, or at least fully service it. Not implying that an aftermarket scan tool can't properly service a vehicle to some extent, but there's going to be a limit.
Do you think that people really want to fully service the vehicle?
Yeah, I don't know if it's a want thing or they just don't know that they're not.
So they don't know what they don't know.
That's got to be part of it. And then part of it, like a lot of their arguments are, is, well, we've never ran into an issue where we've needed one. How can that be? How can my shop in a little town in Minnesota run into scenarios, maybe not daily, but I'd say pretty close, where the factory tool was needed, maybe not to diagnose the problem, but to carry out the entire repair, whether it was, you know, coding, programming, initializations, the aftermarket tool wouldn't do it.
That depends how honest you are with what's acceptable and what's not, and what is actually required. You know, there's a lot of procedures you can skip and get the car gone.
So you're talking shortcuts.
I don't know if shortcut's the right word.
Okay.
Because a shortcut kind of suggests that you get to the same place.
Getting the car gone, are you fixing it correctly? Are you diagnosing it correctly? Or is it just you think you've gotten it handled? I mean, getting the car gone to me is very muddy.
It is, absolutely. That's kind of my intention with the statement. That's why I'm hesitant to even call it a shortcut, because it...
Maybe you fixed the car, maybe you didn't.
Right. But yeah, it goes away and you get paid for it. Right.
Maybe a good example, and I don't want to say like no aftermarket tool will do some of this stuff, but we're kind of picking out shops that have a scan tool, maybe two, both aftermarket, and maybe a battery registration is a good example.
How many scan tools does a shop need, Matt?
Needs a really strong word. I mean, I got to think that if you're fully capable of servicing, 60, 70% of what comes in the door, that would be pretty good. And the rest, you do what you can. Be honest with yourself. Be honest with the client. And, you know, I'm not saying you need an OE tool on every car that comes in that's you don't have OE tooling for to properly service or perform some functions. But I don't understand the shops that have zero ability to fully service a car line beginning to end. That I just can't get my head wrapped around that. And a lot of them aren't particularly expensive.
Right. What do you think, Pete?
Well, I think the comment brings a question to mind. You know, every shop is going to have a different answer to this, and everybody in the business may have a different answer. What are your big three? You know, everybody used to think it was just Ford, GM, Chrysler, right? Okay. What are your big three in your shop, man?
Last time I checked was a couple of weeks ago. Number one was still General Motors. And then number two is split almost perfectly between Ford and Volkswagen Audi. And then after that is Fiat Chrysler stuff. And that includes Jeep. And then after that, it's Toyota, BMW, Honda. And after that, it just goes like shotgun blast, splatter pattern.
Sure. It's an interesting... I'm sure you didn't guess that.
No, I would have never. No.
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 Because to think that Volkswagen Audi is a top three for you is kind of surprising.
Very.
I'm sure you were surprised when you saw it.
I was stunned.
Mm-hmm. I mean, they're like circa 1972, though, right?
Yeah, they're old. Okay. Volkswagen diesel rabbits.
Sciroccos. And-
yeah.
So years ago, I had a conversation with a guy from Snap-on that really made me think. And obviously, he's a Snap-on guy, so he's selling Snap-on tools, whatnot. But we're talking about scan tools, and it was how many scan tools do you need? And in the discussion, he says, well, how many ratchets do you have in your toolbox? I'll bet it's more than 13. And I'm like, this guy's freaking nuts. And I started counting them. I'm like, son of a bitch. That's way more than 13. So if I need more than 13 ratchets to fix the cars I work on, how the heck does one scan tool fix all the cars I work on?
Did you go back and really think that through and looked at eight of them and said, I don't need them?
Hell no, I need every single one of them.
Obviously, you're not any good if you need that many ratchets. Well, I wanted everybody that's listening to, you know, understand that.
Yeah.
It's more of a Bob thing than anything else.
Yeah. Yeah, 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 yeah. No, I was really shocked at how many ratchets I own. I mean, how many ratchets would you think you own? It's pretty weird. Start talking, I mean.
You just think of the two or three that you grab all the most, time.
Yeah. Right. Versus... You're not thinking of the quarter, the 3/8, the half, the air.
Oh, right. Yeah, you had those two. Jeez. Yeah.
The electric. You start, holy crap, I got 20 freaking ratchets. I got $1,000.
Any of them in a year.
Yeah.
No. Did you ever get your teeth cleaned and saw the array of tools that are, you know, sitting behind you?
Yeah, that haven't changed since 1942.
Well, I don't know. I saw a weird new tool the other day, and I said, you're not going to use that on my mouth.
Whoa, this is a family show.
Right. This is not that kind of podcast, Carm.
But if there's that many shop owners or managers that don't know that this is required, or they're just under the impression that they got things handled, their guys are maybe just that good. Is it the techs don't know, or they're just not talking? They don't say anything because they figure it won't garner a response of, yeah, let's look into getting that, you know, these GM tools or whatever car line, it doesn't matter.
Matt, out of those six that you talked to us about, six or seven, do you have all OE tools?
Yes.
Okay. Will any aftermarket tool substitute in any way for any of those?
Absolutely, because I think there's a lot of stuff aftermarket tools do better. Typically, aftermarket scan tools are handheld now. Most OE tools are PC-based, so handheld has an advantage for just sheer speed. And then aftermarket tools typically will, from what I've seen on most cases, graph better, or better for, like, I would say, drivability diagnostics. They come in, they're just a little handier, quicker. But when you start getting outside of that, then the OE tools start coming into play. And then certain OE tools, the requirement isn't even so much the tool's ability to interface with the vehicle. It's service information built into the tool. So, for instance, today I had a 2016 Volvo that I was pulling a code for a rear parking aid. Well, all my aftermarket tools could pull the code, but none of them identified it. It was all undefined. And you can't go to aftermarket service information and find out what that code means. I got Volvo Vita, the factory tool. And I mean, it's just awesome how it pulls the code, tells me what the code description is, leads me into a fault plan, or a test plan, guided fault finding. You know, not that it was a particularly difficult thing to diagnose, but it was so fast and easy. The worst part was getting it fired up, getting my password reset because I didn't, you know.
Hey, you didn't use it or change your password in the 90 days of Volvo.
Right. Yeah. So
But on the same hand, or not same hand, but I mean on the opposite direction, I had, this is a couple of years ago, I had a vehicle. I'm using the OE scan tool. It's got a new ECM, and you got to do theft and program a VIN and all this. And the OE scan tool wouldn't program the VIN for me. I had to grab an aftermarket tool to get the job done.
Nice.
So all tools have holes in them.
Yep.
And I think that's part of the reason why one tool doesn't work.
Yeah, I think you'd be maybe not in quite the same trouble, but there would be issues if you were a shop that only had OE tools. I think there's definitely reasons
like the dealer? To have.
Dealer runs into problems, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
That can't be true. I've had customers tell me how great they are. It's got to be true. It's got to be true that they're awesome. Who does the responsibility really fall on to know what the OE, what the proper tool is, and to make the proper tool work and be ready to use when it's, you know, maybe you're not, you don't need it every day, or the aftermarket tool is quicker to use, or you're more comfortable with it. That makes guys less likely to use an OE tool.
Right.
So yeah. Then the thing sits until it's needed. Absolutely no workaround other than the OE tool. And now it's out of date, or you have to reset your Volvo password, or, you know, you have to do some huge download because it's.
Yeah.
So are you saying take everything to the dealer?
No, I'm just saying, where does that responsibility, who does that responsibility lie on?
I tell you, when I was at a brick and mortar shop, there was one guy in the shop who was tasked, I mean, shop foreman, with making sure all the tools were up to date. He was the guy that was supposed to know how the tools worked if other guys had issues. What, did everybody know how to use the tools? Heck, I was doing a GM evap test, and one guy comes up and starts telling me to run the automated test. And I'm like, here, hand, let me show you my tech too, and you tell me where it is in this tool. And he didn't understand when I own the tool, I tend to know how to use it fairly well. I mean, not perfect, but I mean, better than if I don't own it.
Yeah, but I think as for the masses, the technician owning the tool, I think is just
unrealistic.
Very, yeah.
Yeah, and I'm thinking
got to keep in mind that the we're kind of sick in that way.
Yeah, definitely sick. I'm thinking like shop. How is the shop structured? Partly, so my shop. I'm the main diag guy. That's pretty much my life. Not only, even if I didn't just do it at the shop, it's kind of what interests me. So it falls on me to do it. I think other shops where they're divided up, where maybe you have car line specialists, not that that's really common, but I suspect it'll become more common, that the individual tech will be responsible for that car line scan tool. And then maybe,
Do you see it really being car line or... more of a, steering suspension. That guy takes care of that stuff. The drivability guy, electronics, I mean, subsections that way versus the guy that's the Nissan guy. You got to have a big shop to have that, don't you think?
I would think it'd have to be fairly big, unless you're limited car lines. Like you were saying, all I'm going to work on are these 2, 5, 6 car lines. That's it. You may have a shop structured where you have a couple domestic techs, a couple Asian techs, and a Euro tech. Or like you're saying, our shop is laid out very much like you said, Bob, where diag tech, kind of an undercar, and then R&R, underhood, if you will, is laid out very much like that. They need scan tools. Most of what they do is with aftermarket tools. They get away, can do quite a bit of what they need that way. And then if it goes beyond that, then I'm involved. You know, it's like Pete said, keeping all of this stuff, keeping track of it all, keeping on top of it as best you can. You haven't used a factory tool on the independent world for months, there's often hurdles, you know, large downloads, password resets. If there's a big time difference, like when you're sending the email or the help request, it's going to, you know, Europe. It's not domestic. You might have to wait a day to get any kind of help. So there's hurdles that way. And usually it falls on one person to kind of work through that. You know, if the manager's doing what he needs to be doing, it's probably going to be difficult for him or her to keep on track of like the scan tool stuff. You'd like it to fall on the techs or a tech that deals primarily with that world.
This whole dialogue started by you talking professionalism. And how do we wrap that around the tool requirements?
So what does it take to become a professional shop? I think it takes a situation of awareness to know what you work on and what you need to properly fix the car. It requires you to have more tooling than you probably do and more training than you probably do.
Matt, let's look at a guy like you who in your marketplace is known as a top-notch master diagnostician. People bring their problems to you. Do you see that happening more and more because you've got the investment?
Oh, most definitely, because I have the tool to do the job.
You know how to use it. Yeah, you're staying current with it. And the professional shop at the other end who claims state-of-the-art diagnostic like you opened in the middle can claim that because they've got you in their back pocket.
That, and I was going to say when you said that, I usually don't call out specific scan tools, but I'm going to pick on Volkswagen Audi Otis, that it is one of the least intuitive tools I've used, but mostly because of my experience with scan tools leading up to it. And the only reason I could figure out how to use it reasonably was because of a background using the BMW scan tool, that there was parallels that led me to be able to use that properly. Kind of what you're saying is having the tools, using them, investing the time, even if you don't really need it for this particular vehicle, that if you've just received it or you've it's kind of trying to get seat time with this tool to properly, or to at least learn to use it as best you can. And like Bob said, hit some training, you know, and learn more about what this tool can do. You know, how many people have owned, you know, VagCom and never knew that it could graph? That's common.
But what are realistically, I mean, a good, better, best scenario, right? What is, what are solutions that are good, better, best for a shop to maintain a level of professionalism? Obviously, subletting to the dealer when you can't do it is a solution, right? Maybe not the best, but it's a solution.
Yep.
Mobile guys.
Yep.
Solution. You know, maybe you use some combination of solutions, of course. Makes sense. Maybe you pick your two or three that you guys do, right? Because like you said, I mean, you know, not really something I look into, but I got to think that those top three or four manufacturers that the shop is doing is a huge percentage of total business.
Yeah. And I don't think the cost of getting into the game is that much.
Oh, and what about networking with a few shops around you? You buy these tools. And you buy these tools and you buy these tools, and let's not share the tools. Let's right. not here. I'll let you use this tool. I own it. And when it comes and breaks, you don't take responsibility and I have to fix it. Now I'm upset. I just take and give you the car. You look at it, figure it out, bring it back to me. I sell it, whatever.
Ugh, so, sounds awful.
There's no perfect situation, though, is there?
I agree. But
I'm just throwing out a scenario.
That's definitely, you know what, and it's probably a better scenario than relying on just dealerships, right?
Yeah. I mean, at least if the shop has, you got a guy or two in a shop that knows how to use that tool, he should be more proficient with it, right?
Should be. I guess my knee-jerk reaction when I heard the question was honesty. and then educating the techs, educating themselves to whittle down that not knowing what you don't know, you know, trying to reduce that so that you can be very honest and say, okay, we put this part on, but it needs more. We don't have the proper tooling to do it. This is where it's got to go. I'm going to call you guys in to take care of that. I'm going to ship it to the dealer. I'm going to ship it to another, you know, quote unquote competitor down the street, have them finish this repair. And then I'm going to go to the manager or the shop owner and say, look, we couldn't fully repair this vehicle because I didn't have this. This would allow me to do that. And I'll have you know, we run into this a lot. We're running a lot of cars over to the dealer. We're calling in so-and-so to do this a lot. And this car line makes up a very large percentage of what we work on. If it's, you know, the once in a great while thing, you know, there's a lot of freaking scan tools I have. Pete pointed out perfectly, there's a sickness involved. A lot of scan tools I have that get used once a year.
We've just been kind of started off with professionalism, and it gravitated towards scan tools and whatnot. But let's face it, we've got trade. I hate to use the word industry. It's more trade what we're talking about. That guys can't even, I don't want,
there's kind of guys a hypocrisy.
Out there, but there's guys out there that, I mean, can't even tuck in their shirt. They right. don't even take a shower on a regular basis. I mean, if you don't have self pride as far as taking care of yourself and understanding that your job is to take care of the company. What you do to take care of the company is fixing cars. We got to get to the basic steps before you can even get to the scan tools.
Absolutely. And it's a hypocrisy, I feel, that the growing demand and complaint about undercompensation and not being respected, you know, somebody finds out you fix cars for a living. Oh, I didn't know you struggled in school. And other service trades that compensate much, much better for skill sets that are much narrower than what most in this trade have. So we're beating this drum of, you know, treat us more like the professionals we are. But then that same person is, like you said, looks a mess, whether it's not tucking in shirts or, you know, cripes a technician's bathroom, you know, like,
oh my Lord.
Well, there's a,
I won't wash my hands in some of them because I'm worried about getting dirtier.
I don't know who said it. I maybe should have researched it first, but somebody said you could judge society by, you know, the prison system, how our society's progressed or the state of society. And I think that's maybe bunk now, that really it's public restrooms and traffic for society. You can tell
Church
a lot about
parking lot.
You can tell a lot about a shop and its technicians by their freaking restroom and work areas. How can you sit there and go, we need to be treated like professionals, but you don't really present yourself in any way as a professional?
Walking around in a half inch of grease. Yeah.
I don't. And that's not just the techs, the shop owners too, you know, and now you're trying to sell this client on why your labor rate is this and your parts markup is that. And all these things you provide them as a service, and the place looks a mess.
It's the external image, but it's more critical that it, you know, I've always said that it comes from inside out.
Right.
And if they're not going to take care of the inside, we deserve what the outside says about us.
It's a bigger picture than most people want to really admit to, I think.
Hey, Carm here. Now, you know I attend Apex in Las Vegas each year. It's my must-attend show for one simple reason. It keeps me up to date on everything in the global automotive aftermarket industry. At Apex, I see, touch, and compare the latest new tools and equipment in the industry. I learn how new technology is affecting independent repair shops. I sit in on advanced training sessions on underhood service and alternative fuel vehicles. And so important, I network with others facing the same opportunities and challenges. I know many of you are shop owners, managers, or technicians. I also know going to Apex means time away from your business. But I simply don't know how you can stay ahead of the huge transformation and changes taking place in the industry without attending Apex. Hey, make Apex your must-attend show. The dates are Tuesday, November 5th through Thursday, November 7th at the Sands Expo in Las Vegas. Registration? It's only $40, and it only takes a few minutes. Go to aapexshow.com. So how do we get the choir to start singing better, doing better, uplifting themselves?
Personally, I listened to your podcast earlier in April with Matt and Scott Brown, and I think it was Justin, wasn't it?
Yeah, Morgan.
Yeah. And George was on.
And George. And I was on my way down to Tennessee listening to it, and I talked to Matt along the way, and I talked to Scott Brown along the way about that whole podcast and what it would take to make technicians professional. My personal feelings are we need to get to some sort of situation with lawyers, like a bar. You have to meet certain requirements in order to practice. And if you don't meet those requirements, you can't practice. And if you fail to meet those requirements, you know, maybe like airlines with the airline mechanics, you get one chance. You fail, you're out, you never practice again.
Wait, did you just suggest accountability?
Damn!
I don't get it.
It would be a situation. I mean, one of my things with like internet groups, whether it be some of the professional ones or Facebook or whatever, is I am not going to just hand out information to people that are looking for how do I fix this car. It has to be, give me the information that you've done, and I need to know that you want to learn, not just get the car out of my bay. You're looking for silver bullets. I'm not your guy. I think that is a situation that enables and devalues us as a whole. So I would rather have that guy not get information and move on to a different occupation. Because obviously...
Well, we've already got a shortage, Bob. I don't know that...
We have a shortage of what?
Competent people.
Because why? We have an abundance of incompetent shops. Supply and demand says if you can get rid of the incompetent shops, the competent shops should then rise. The value of the shop and the technician should rise. Pay levels will rise. I mean, that I learned this stuff in high school. I don't know. I mean, I'm not a smart guy. But, I mean, I think that there's some certain things that are pretty logical that should say, if you get rid of the chaff...
You can make bread.
Yeah. Or beer!
Oh, my God. I totally forgot about that. But I'm a wine guy. Grapes don't have chaff, do they?
You can make vodka, gin, lots of stuff with grain. Yeah.
By the way, that episode that you're talking about was 414. We recorded that at Vision. It was a great episode. It was a lot of great dialogue. It was about elevating the tech mechanic and how are we going to do it. Thanks for bringing that up. Yeah, professionalism. We got to figure out in this industry how to run better shops and how to make more money and how to make this one of the best professions, one of the most highest high-tech professions in our industry. And your point is so right. There's just too many.
I don't think
many...
it has to be that high-tech necessarily. I mean, there's a lot of room and a lot of value in, what would you call it, a general service technician or at least identifying what these levels are, right? I think that
there's a lot of nuts and bolts stuff that goes with our stuff.
Absolutely.
Yeah, but you're right, but you know, that's a given. I think it's always going to be there, but if we, you know, and I
right, but we still need to define that. And and set an expectation for what each level is and does.
But the professionalism shouldn't change, right?
Well, I think they should.
The professionalism part?
Well, I think the level of professionalism expected from a lube tech as opposed to a top diagnostic technician or, a heavy R&R guy or whatever.
I'm not following this. You got to really open that up and explain why.
So a well-seasoned
nuts and bolts guy doesn't have to be as professional as the guy that is using the scan tool. So the untuck my shirt, hang a rag out of my back pocket, not wash my hands, all that kind of stuff is acceptable by the nuts and bolts guy?
Well, I'm not saying to that degree. I'm just saying.
Let me bail you out a little bit here, Peter. We started this interesting dialogue here because I talked about it as being a high-tech industry. And let me just share with you what my thoughts are is if because we improved our professionalism and the level of high tech on vehicles today is huge, you can talk nuts and bolts, but some of those hard parts that we're going to touch someday are going to have sensors and wires and stuff on them. Some of them already do. And if that means it's high tech and we can build a profession, then I think we could call ourselves a high-tech industry because that vehicle that we're working on is nothing but high-tech. You know, Ethernet networks. Think of what you're going to need someday to get inside to work on it and fix on it. And if we don't start building something today to change that image, which is, I think, part of our dialogue here, the tools you use, the professionalism that we have, it starts somewhere. I think so many high-tech industries have some low-tech jobs that build up, but it's still, the umbrella is still high tech. And we've got to be able to pay to get those people to move up to those 100K jobs.
This kind of resonates with a town hall a couple weeks ago. And I think Rick White was on there. And he had said something about the curse of knowledge. I don't know if I agree with the wording. I agree with where he was going with it. I agree with that. And he was speaking towards how value is assigned. And that when you're cursed with knowledge, that you tend to blow it off as easy. But I don't know that a lot of industries, I don't know that they necessarily do that. You know, the medical industry pops into my head right away. Like, there could be a few that would succeed working as a, doctor at a clinic or a physician's assistant without any training, and they would get a few diagnoses correct. Like, you've gone to the doctor where you kind of know you have a sinus infection, you know you have an ear infection, but you get charged regardless. And I know there's other caveats with health insurance and all that, but there's no devaluing what service they're providing you. Where in our world, it seems like the more familiar you are with something or the more often you've done something, the more easily you find it to not charge appropriately for it or stand behind or stick up for charging what you're charging for it, if that makes sense.
Rick did say curse of knowledge, but it was Cecil who told the story of the guy, the carpenter, who walked in to the squeaky floor for the customer. And he walked all over the floor. He looked, he listened, and then he took his nail and a hammer and bam. And he put it into a special spot on the floor, and the floor stopped to squeak. And he said that would be $300. And the customer said, $300 for 5 minutes of work? He goes, yes, but it was 30 years of experience to know where to put the nail. And the objective was is that we're so good at what we have, the knowledge base, we can fix it or diagnose sometimes a vehicle because of the knowledge that we have, and we decide to give away all that knowledge by charging a quarter of an hour instead of the 1 hour of diag time or whatever it really would have taken. And we're undervaluing ourselves. That was, I think, the point. That's where you're going.
Yeah, and I find it just fascinating because I haven't figured out why this trade typically ends up doing that.
So why? To compare the two, I'll give you a second here, Pete, because I think you'll expound on this. To compare the two of the mechanic or auto repair and the doctor, you're not taking into account the insurance and how stuff is coded and how that's the only way they can get dollars is by charging by coding, not by that. Pete?
Right. And that's kind of my point. Kind of the point exactly, because, you know, you got a lot of big business figuring out how to properly bill all this stuff, billing each line, and not changing the value or going ahead and adding that premium labor rate, or, you know, that specialist, whatever, you go to a specialist, you pay more. That's a fact. I mean, but they've positioned themselves to give the customer, client, insurance company, the patient, the perceived value. I don't know that we can do that.
Years ago, I was asked about charging for something and how much, this guy asked me, how much should I charge for this? And my feelings on charging stuff are, I want the customer, when they look at the bill, to wince and then write the check. When they wince and write the check, I feel that I've hit the sweet spot. They're a little shocked at how much it is, but they're not offended. If they are like, holy crap, and bitching, you know, I'm too high. If they're like, holy crap, let me write the check, I gave it away.
Yeah.
You know, so if they wince, but I mean, it's a situation you got to be able, big business has figured it out. Most of the small business, they're not businessmen.
Right.
The majority are not businessmen. They're guys that just went into business and are trying to make a living instead of how do I become the next Amazon or whatever.
What I find interesting is how we devalue that knowledge, that understanding. So when we're sitting talking about this stuff, there's a certain level of knowledge we've all gained through schooling, experience, training classes, etc., networking from one another. And it's maybe a reach, but I thought it's a good indicator or a good reference. Have you ever been on YouTube and watched an interview with the late Dr. Richard Feynman, Dr. Richard Feynman, where a BBC interviewer is asking him, when I hold two magnets together in a certain way, I feel a force pushing them apart. And Feynman responds, oh, you're feeling, you know, magnetism, a force. And then the interviewer asks again, or the journalist, you know, yeah, but what is that? And Feynman goes into a fairly extensive story about, you know, ice and falling on the ice and breaking a hip if you're an alien, how much we take for granted for knowledge. Just between you and me, if I told you somebody fell on the ice, slipped on the ice and had to go to the hospital, you'd put two and two together, you'd kind of follow along. Take somebody totally out of that, an alien, if you will, they'd be like, what do you mean?
Gravity, right?
Right. What's a hospital? What's a wife? What's this person? Why would you go to the hospital? What does falling on the ice have to do with getting hurt? Blah, blah, blah. What is ice? Why is it slippery? And it steamrolls. And the reason I bring it up is that being in this trade, we have a lot of accumulated knowledge that interacts and intertwines. And yet when we're behind the counter talking to somebody about their vehicle, they don't have anywhere near that base knowledge. And we're talking about some fairly complex things. And, you know, we can make things as complex as we want, honestly. But sometimes we oversimplify so much to the point that we devalue what we're actually doing and lowering that perceived value to the person on the opposite side of that counter when they're going to write that check. And I'm not saying to necessarily go over the board and just pump ourselves up into something totally unrealistic and totally dishonest. But I think we got to give ourselves a little more credit than we do. This problem, to track it down, this vibration, this noise, this electrical problem, or just servicing the vehicle deserves probably more credit than we give ourselves for. And why is it
you know, in this continued race to the bottom and a bunch of people just unwittingly standing on the gas, doesn't they wake up and go, you know, what we do is skill. There is a level of knowledge we have that we take too much for granted, way too much.
I'm extremely guilty of exactly what you're talking about. A lot of it is because I want the conversation over with. To be completely honest. you know, like, it's really difficult to relate to a person at a certain level of technical understanding and actually feel like I'm going to actually communicate close to what actually went on and what happened.
And I appreciate it every day.
But I can't recommend watching that video enough. And just kind of twist it a little bit and relate it to auto repair. And again, I'm not saying for us to all just become a bunch of, you know, pompous a-holes.
Matt, given what you just said about how we take for granted stuff, yes. This is going back a few months, but you and Pete wouldn't understand this. I'd have to get somebody a little lower level. But racking a car, putting a car on a hoist and lifting it up, and what it takes to do that, and how, who thinks about it? They just get down there.
Scary stuff.
Well, you know,
what I see sometimes is,
I was at a shop with a guy, and I mean, all of a sudden I hear this crash, and oh my God, oh my God. And I looked over, and the freaking truck has fallen off the hoist and has pinned this guy. I mean, that was one of the scariest days, and I wasn't even involved with it. But it, I mean, when you're talking about take for granted, and I mean, that's one of the simplest things that we do. Well, not you and Pete, I understand, but low level guys like myself. you know, it's just one of those things that when you're talking stuff, you know, you always think about how easy stuff is, and you don't realize what easy to you is extremely hard for somebody else. And it can go the other way around too.
Yeah. And just the level of knowledge we have, you know, why did my ignition coil go bad? I have to oversimplify this to the point of probably outright lying to you, because we're not in the shared space of knowledge.
It was because the carbon tracked spark plug.
Maybe. You know, but you and I think nothing of that comment. What about my next door neighbor? Would she have a clue what that means? Oh, okay. I don't understand. I know I say that a lot. I don't understand, but I don't. I don't understand why it seems to be rampant in this trade.
Because people work on their own cars all the time. They go to parts stores that give away service. And the Snap-on guy I mentioned earlier, we're talking recently, and he tells me a story about parts stores. I mean, you name it, that go out and scan codes in the parking lot, put wiper blades on, whatever. And how shop owners in towns have gone to the city council and say, hey, they're not zoned as an auto repair service place. They cannot perform these services. I'm sorry, but I applaud those guys that are doing that, because that brings value to us.
Yeah, I agree.
Shocked at what I just heard. That's all I'll say about it.
What did you say?
I said I'm shocked at what I just heard.
Oh.
Are you suggesting that, like, government regulation?
Well, it's already government regulation. I'm saying capitalize on it for the purpose.
Since it's already in existence.
It's already in place. The zoning is the zoning. Just hold the government accountable.
Okay.
Well, that and the independent shop that's buying all these parts from the stores that do that, not pulling away all their business and finding entities that are there for them, you know, to service the professional repair shop and not the motoring public itself, that they could
they could help push these stores to maybe stop doing the code scans.
Good luck on that one. The other thing I was going to mention with the comparison to other trades, and specifically medical with your example earlier, you know, if you want to go in and get an estimate on what it's going to cost, they have no idea. Good luck. The other thing is the most of the shops, the guy that makes the ultimate, that kind of lays out the blueprint on how pricing and, you know, value is determined in the business, especially in medical, that guy ain't there. You can't complain to him.
Yeah.
A lot of these shops, that guy is there every day. The guy that makes that decision, you're talking to him in all likelihood, you know, or he's right there, you know. That's a huge factor in why, you know, you feel that pressure and think on your feet, why are you worth money right now? You know what I mean? It gets tricky. I'm not excusing it. I'm just suggesting it's a real challenge.
I love the whole doctor analogy. Matt, when you talk to a consumer about the work you need to do to diagnose their car, are you using the word diagnostics or testing?
I've been favoring analysis or analyzing.
Okay.
The diagnosis is what I come up with, but it's not like the act itself.
You know, I've been thinking about the fact that you go, you know, hey, doc, it hurts here. Well, listen, we got to do a test. Yep. And what will you determine? Well, this is what we'll figure out. And if that's not right, we'll do another test. And I have to keep paying along the way for all of these different tests to figure it out. Yet for car repair, we're unwilling to respect what you guys tell us we have to do to figure out the problem.
Yep. Now, given that whole conversation you guys just had, I know there's some people that love to name drop. I'm not really fond of that, but I do have to use the guy's name for this because he was a trainer at the time. But Jim Linder, the first time I took one of his classes, he got into why are we doing diagnosis? And he says, diagnosis, if you look up the word in the dictionary, is meaning you found the problem right then and there. We should never be diagnosing anything. We should be performing tests and coming to a hopeful conclusion. Doctors don't diagnose. Doctors perform tests. And when those tests give them answers, they perform more tests and they charge for all the tests. It was a profound statement to me, and I don't know, 15 years ago or so. When you start looking at the English language and the words we use, we improperly use the words. Do we make estimates or do we perform or do we give quotes? I don't give quotes. I give estimates. Quotes are solid. They're in concrete. There's too much stuff in the English language that we just misuse and muddy.
No, you're right. There needs to be a qualifying term to diagnostics, like differential or a diagnostic process, or these are the tests along the way. But you're right. It all gets muddy because, you know, I would feel like a fish out of water. It's not exactly the term I wanted to use there. But anyhow, if I were to say, well, we have to perform a differential diagnosis and I have to consult my colleague, Bob or Matt, we will we'll analyze the data together. It's like, come on, dude, you know?
But if you were a lawyer and you said, I'm going to consult with my guy, you're getting charged for the other guy, too.
Right. Absolutely.
Automotive repair has almost been perceived as so simple that why are you going through all this extra work, guys? You're fluffing this up?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's how it's perceived.
That is the perception. Absolutely. Yeah.
Because grandpa could do a flip on the choke years ago and the car would run better.
So what does it take to be professional? I think that we need to look outside of the automotive world and look at what we consider other people to be professional. I mean, doctors, lawyers, whatever. Honestly, Walmart greeters. What does it take to be professional? What do you see as a value as the person that you want on the front lines? I mean, how do they conduct themselves? That's what I look at. And when I think about who, if I had a brick and mortar shop, would I want at my front counter? I want somebody that is appealing to anybody and everybody. I want as conservative and clean cut, and they're just non-offensive. Nobody can be offended by them versus the today's norm, tattoo sleeves, nose piercings, all that kind of stuff. If I had a brick and mortar shop, I have no problem hiring that person for the back room, but they'd never be at my front counter.
What do you want in your back room? What kind of professional do you want there?
Somebody that fixed the car right the first time.
Committed to training
and
constant learning.
Constant learning. And, you know, and it would be somebody that would be a team player. It's not about looks back there. In my sense, I guess back in the back room is looks is I want somebody that's going to walk around shirt tucked in, no rags hanging out of the pocket. I mean, this is
what's wrong just, with a rag in the pocket.
You know, I grew up in the gas station era as you did, and that is just a sign of just grease monkey slob. Just okay, if you want to fold it up like a hanky and that it's not hanging out, you can have a rag in your pocket.
Oh, a neatly folded one.
Right. Yeah. Sure. Just. It is about appearance and about how you conduct yourself and how you carry yourself. I mean, you walk around like a slob, you're a slob. If you walk around like you have pride in yourself, there's pride.
I think there's a huge amount of holes in that. And I think that this conversation actually raised more questions for me than it answered, which is typical for me. Every time I try to... I think Matt and, well, Bob, you too, every time we have a discussion, I think we cause more problems than we solve, quite honestly. And I'm totally okay with that because most of it is my eyes being open to different perspectives and ideas. But what I'm struggling with here, I think the biggest thing is to more neatly define professionalism and into maybe categories of appearance, of aptitude, of... So I think it gets compartmentalized specifically into your role. You know, Bob, you're a very conscientious person, I believe. So orderliness ranks high for you. I think the majority of genius-type people throughout history have been not that way at all. Somewhat slobs, very, you know, kind of living in chaos, if you will. Is that professional? Probably not. You know, it probably isn't. But there's a place for those people. And they're very useful. So I think it raises a lot more challenges because ultimately we do, you know, we have niches in this business that different personality types are going to fit. You know, the social butterfly, maybe he's not in the back wrenching. Or the snowflakes, they're not in the back wrenching. I don't know if that makes any sense to our discussion or not, but that's just my quick take on it.
I keep coming back to associating professionalism with being honest, and particularly brutally honest with yourself. If you're the shop owner or shop manager, being brutally honest with yourself and looking at that business front of house, back of house with no distortion as best you can, unbiased, undistorted view, be very honest. And it might suck. You know, it might really, really suck to first look in the mirror and then go look at the business itself. Are you delivering on what you say you're delivering on? And then the next thing is, I think just caring about what you do and doing it at a high level, what you would say a professional level, which would be much better than the masses, and doing what it takes to be able to deliver that, whether it is equipping yourself with tools and equipment or education, training, studying, and then experience. And if you need help, like, you know, Pete, I think, has a crazy good memory. A lot of people don't have that level of a memory. If he did something 5 years ago, he probably remembers pretty accurately what he did, how he got there. A lot of people cannot do that. And that's not a knock on them at all. But if you're not that type of person, we have PCs everywhere in the shop. And if you don't, maybe you should. And you could get PowerPoint or Open Office, something of that nature. And you can start making notes, photos, type out some notes on how you did this, how you got there, giving it a really long title because, you know, most of our operating systems now have really good search functions. Then it's there at the ready. Like, hey, I think I've run into this before. Let me review my notes. Oh, okay. If I go to this connector with this tool and look at this, I have an example of good data. Now I'm on the right track and I'm shaving time off. I guess that would be the beginning of professionalism. And then also the logic of doing what the common sense thing to get where you need to go, whether increasing our perceived value, well, then you have to project an image of being something of value. That's just logic. Why aren't we doing that? Why is it always seem to be devalued, devalued, devalued?
Pete, I loved what you said. I mean, I totally respect your perspective on things. And Matt, I love what you just said, but you know, it was interesting the way you said maybe we should record some of the things that we learn, and that shows the professionalism of you wanting to remember and become better at what you do.
That recording of that data is a huge way to remember it for later anyway. I mean, John was just telling us a month or two ago, I think. I forgot the exact progression of it, but it's you do something, you read something, you do something, you record what you did. From an educational standpoint, you will have a higher probability of recalling that information.
The more senses you use, the higher the chances of you retaining that information. Listen to it, say it, write it, and you will learn it and retain it better.
I'm a vehement note taker, and I think it's because I want to remember, and part of my want to remember is to write it or type it.
The thing that amazes me the most about that statement, Carm, is that one note you keep having: find replacement for Bob.
He doesn't actually go back and read his notes. He just keeps writing it down.
Oh, okay.
And stop crying himself to sleep at night.
I didn't think I shared that private note. Damn, Matt. Matt, did you send it to him?
No.
You shared your screen.
Pete's my favorite hacker. I mean, we're all, yeah, you got no secret.
When you're putting up the note that says, Matt, you're putting me to sleep, I think it was kind of hung off to the side, find a replacement for Bob.
This was great, guys. I got to think back. This went in a lot of crazy in different places, and I think it was very, very profound, as the previous six episodes have been, the Technician Roundtable Part 7 with Bob Hype, Pete Landry, and Matt Fonslow. Guys, thanks for your wisdom, your craziness, and for gracing the podcast airwaves again with another great episode.
Thank you, Carl.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for being on board to listen and learn from the premier automotive aftermarket podcast. Until next time.